the tastiest lure imaginable. He can pretend he's suicidal. It wouldn't be hard, because until very recently he has been. He's sure that meditations on the attractiveness of death would keep Mr. Mercedes talking for a while, but for how long before the guy realized he was being played? This is no hopped-up moke who believes the police really are going to give him $1 million and a 747 that will fly him to El Salvador. Mr. Mercedes is a very intelligent person who happens to be crazy. Hodges draws his legal pad onto his lap and turns to a fresh page. Halfway down, he writes half a dozen words in large capitals. I have to wind him up. He puts a box around this, places the legal pad in the case file he has started, and closes the thickening folder. He sits a moment longer, looking at the screensaver photo of his daughter, who is no longer 5 and no longer thinks he's God. Good night, Allie. He turns off his computer and goes to bed. He doesn't expect to sleep, but he does. 19. He wakes up at 2:19 a.m. by the bedside clock with the answer as bright in his mind as a neon bar sign. It's risky, but right. The kind of thing you do without hesitation or you don't do at all. He goes into his office, a large pale ghost in boxer shorts. He powers up his computer. He goes to Debbie's blue umbrella and clicks, Get Started Now. A new image appears. This time, the young couple is on what looks like a magic carpet floating over an endless sea. The silver rain is falling, but they are safe and dry beneath the blue umbrella. There are 2 buttons below the carpet. Register now on the left and enter password on the right. Hodges clicks enter password, and in the box that appears, he types Kermit Frog 19. He hits return, and a new screen appears. On it is this message. Merce Kill wants to chat with you. Do you want to chat with Merce Kill? Y. N. He puts the cursor on Y and clicks his mouse. A box for his message appears. Hodges types quickly without hesitation. 20. 3 miles away at 49 Elm Street in Northfield, Brady Hartsfield can't sleep. His head thumps. He thinks, Frankie. My brother, who should have died when he choked on that apple slice. Life would have been so much simpler if things had happened that way. He thinks of his mother, who sometimes forgets her nightgown and sleeps raw. Most of all, he thinks of the fat ex-cop. At last he gets up and leaves his bedroom, pausing for a moment outside his mother's door, listening to her snore. The most unerotic sound in the universe, he tells himself, but still he pauses. Then he goes downstairs, opens the basement door, and closes it behind him. He stands in the dark and says, Control. But his voice is too hoarse, and the dark remains. He clears his throat and tries again. Control. The lights come on. Chaos lights up his computers, and darkness stops the 7-screen countdown. He sits in front of his number 3. Among the litter of icons is a small blue umbrella. He clicks on it, unaware that he's been holding his breath, until he lets it out in a long, harsh gasp. Kermit Frog 19 wants to chat with you. Do you want to chat with Kermit Frog 19? Y. N. Brady hits Y and leans forward. His eager expression remains for a moment before puzzlement seeps in. Then as he reads the short message over and over, puzzlement becomes first anger and then naked fury. Seen a lot of false confessions in my time, but this one's a dilly. I'm retired, but not stupid. Withheld evidence proves you are not the Mercedes killer. Fuck off, asshole. Brady feels an almost insurmountable urge to slam his fist through the screen, but restrains it. He sits in his chair, trembling all over. His eyes are wide and unbelieving. A minute passes. Two. Three. Pretty soon I'll get up, he thinks. Get up and go back to bed. Only what good will that do? He won't be able to sleep. You fat fuck, he whispers, unaware that hot tears have begun to spill from his eyes. You fat, stupid, useless fuck. It was me. It was me. It was me.
Withheld evidence proves.
That is impossible. He seizes on the necessity of hurting the fat ex-cop, and with the idea the ability to think returns. How should he do that? He considers the question for nearly half an hour, trying on and rejecting several scenarios. The answer, when it comes, is elegantly simple. The fat ex-cop's friend, his only friend so far as Brady has been able to ascertain, is a nigger kid with a white name. And what does the nigger kid love? What does his whole family love? The Irish setter, of course. Odell. Brady recalls his earlier fantasy about poisoning a few gallons of Mr. Tasty's finest and starts laughing. He goes on the internet and begins doing research. My due diligence, he thinks, and smiles. At some point he realizes his headache is gone. Poison bait. 1. Brady Hartsfield doesn't need long to figure out how he's going to poison Jerome Robinson's canine pal, Odell. It helps that Brady is also Ralph Jones, a fictional fellow with just enough bona fides plus a low-limit Visa card to order things from places like Amazon and eBay. Most people don't realize how easy it is to womp up an internet-friendly false identity. You just have to pay the bills. If you don't, things can come unraveled in a hurry. As Ralph Jones, he orders a 2-pound can of Gopher Go and gives Ralphie's mail drop address, the Speedy Postal, not far from Discount Electronics. The active ingredient in Gopher Go is strychnine. Brady looks up the symptoms of strychnine poisoning on the net and is delighted to find that Odell will have a tough time of it. 20 minutes or so after ingestion, muscle spasms start in the neck and head. They quickly spread to the rest of the body. The mouth stretches in a grin, at least in humans, Brady doesn't know about dogs. There may be vomiting, but by then too much of the poison has been absorbed and it's too late. Convulsions set in and get worse until the backbone turns into a hard and constant arch. Sometimes the spine actually snaps. When death comes, as a relief, Brady is sure, it's as a result of asphyxiation. The neural pathways tasked with running air to the lungs from the outside world just give up. Brady can hardly wait. At least it won't be a long wait, he tells himself as he shuts off his 7 computers and climbs the stairs. The stuff should be waiting for him next week. The best way to get it into the dog, he thinks, would be in a ball of nice juicy hamburger. All dogs like hamburger, and Brady knows exactly how he's going to deliver Odell's treat. Barbara Robinson, Jerome's little sister, has a friend named Hilda. The two girls like to visit Zoni's Go-Mart, the convenience store a couple of blocks from the Robinson house. They say it's because they like the grape ices, but what they really like is hanging out with their other little friends. They sit on the low stone wall at the back of the store's 4-car parking lot, half a dozen chickadees gossiping and giggling and trading treats. Brady has seen them often when he's driving the Mr. Tasty truck. He waves to them, and they wave back. Everybody likes the ice cream, man. Mrs. Robinson allows Barbara to make these trips once or twice a week. Zoni's isn't a drug hangout, a thing she has probably investigated for herself, but she has put conditions on her approval that Brady has had no trouble deducing. Barbara can never go alone. She always must be back in an hour, She and her friend must always take Odell. No dogs are allowed in the Go-Mart, so Barbara tethers him to the door handle of the outside restroom while she and Hilda go inside to get their grape-flavored ice. That's when Brady, driving his personal car, a nondescript Subaru, will toss Odell the lethal burger ball. The dog is big. He may last 24 hours. Brady hopes so. Grief has a transitive power which is nicely expressed by the axiom, shit rolls downhill. The more pain Odell feels, the more pain the nigger girl and her big brother will feel. Jerome will pass his grief on to the fat ex-cop, a.k.a. Kermit William Hodges, and the fat ex-cop will understand the dog's death is his fault. Payback for sending Brady that infuriating and disrespectful message. When Odell dies, the fat ex-cop will know. Halfway up to the second floor, listening to his mother snoring, Brady stops, eyes wide with dawning realization. The fat ex-cop will know. And that's the trouble, isn't it? Because actions have consequences. It's the reason why Brady might daydream about poisoning a load of the ice cream he sells the kiddies, but wouldn't actually do such a thing. Not as long as he wants to keep flying under the radar, that is, and for now he does. So far, Hodges hasn't gone to his pals in the police department with the letter Brady sent. At first, Brady believed it was because Hodges wanted to keep it between the two of them. Maybe take a shot at tracking down the Mercedes killer himself and getting a little post-retirement glory. But now he knows better. Why would the fucking debt rat want to track him down when he thinks Brady's nothing but a crank? Brady can't understand how Hodges could come to that conclusion when he, Brady, knew about the bleach and the hairnet details never released to the press, but somehow he has. If Brady poisons Odell, Hodges will call in his police pals, starting with his old partner Huntley. Worse, it may give the man Brady hoped to goad into suicide a new reason to live, defeating the whole purpose of the artfully composed letter. That would be completely unfair. Pushing the Trelawney bitch over the edge had been the greatest thrill of his life, far greater, for reasons he doesn't understand or care to, than killing all those people with her car, and he wanted to do it again. To get the chief investigator in the case to kill himself. What a triumph that would be. Brady is standing halfway up the stairs, thinking hard. The fat bastard still might do it, he tells himself. Killing the dog might be the final push he needs. Only he doesn't really buy this, and his head gives a warning throb. He feels a sudden urge to rush back down to the basement, go on the blue umbrella, and demand that the fat ex-cop tell him what bullshit withheld evidence he's talking about so he, Brady, can knock it down. But to do that would be a bad mistake. It would look needy, maybe even desperate. Withheld evidence. Fuck off, asshole. But I did it. I risked my freedom. I risked my life, and I did it. You can't take away the credit. It's not fair. His head throbs again. You stupid cocksucker, he thinks. One way or the other, you're going to pay, but not until after the dog dies. Maybe your nigger friend will die, too. Maybe that whole nigger family will die. And after them, maybe a whole lot of other people. Enough to make what happened at City Center look like a picnic. He goes up to his room and lies down on his bed in his underwear. His head is banging again. His arms are trembling. It's as if he has ingested strychnine. He'll lie here in agony until morning, unless... He gets up and goes back down the hall. He stands outside his mother's open door for almost 4 minutes, then gives up and goes inside. He gets into bed with her, and his headache begins to recede almost at once. Maybe it's the warmth. Maybe it's the smell of her. Shampoo, body lotion, booze. Probably it's both. She turns over. Her eyes are wide in the dark. Oh, honey boy, are you having one of those nights? Yes. He feels the warmth of tears in his eyes. Little witch? Big witch this time. Want me to help you? She already knows the answer. It's throbbing against her stomach. You do so much for me, she says tenderly. Let me do this for you. He closes his eyes. The smell of the booze on her breath is very strong. He doesn't mind, although ordinarily he hates it. Okay. She takes care of him, swiftly and expertly. It doesn't take long. It never does. There, she says. Go to sleep now, honey boy. He does, almost at once. When he wakes in the early morning light, she's snoring again, a lock of hair spit stuck to the corner of her mouth. He gets out of bed and goes back to his own room. His mind is clear. The strychnine-laced gopher poison is on its way. When it arrives, he'll poison the dog and damn the consequences. God damn the consequences. As for those suburban niggers with the white people names, they don't matter. The fat ex-cop goes next after he's had a chance to fully experience Jerome Robinson's pain and Barbara Robinson's sorrow, and who cares if it's suicide? The important thing is that he go. And after that, something big, he says as he pulls on a pair of jeans and a plain white tee. A blaze of glory. Just what the blaze will be, he doesn't know yet, but that's okay. He has time, and he needs to do something first. He needs to demolish Hodge's so-called withheld evidence and convince him that he, Brady, is indeed the Mercedes killer, the monster Hodges failed to catch. He needs to rub it in until it hurts. He also needs it because if Hodges believes in this bogus withheld evidence, the other cops, the real cops, must believe it too. That is unacceptable. He needs credibility, Brady exclaims to the empty kitchen. I need credibility. He sets about making breakfast, bacon and eggs. The smell may waft upstairs to Ma and tempt her. If not, no big deal. He'll eat her share. He's pretty hungry. 2. This time it works. Although when Deborah Ann appears, she's still belting her robe and barely awake. Her eyes are red-rimmed, her cheeks are pale, and her hair flies out every which way. She no longer suffers hangovers exactly, her brain and body have gotten too used to the booze for that, but she spends her mornings in a state of soft focus, watching game shows and popping Tums. Around 2 in the afternoon, when the world starts to sharpen up for her, she pours the day's first drink. If she remembers what happened last night, she doesn't mention it. But then she never does. Neither of them do. We never talk about Frankie either, Brady thinks. And if we did, what would we say? Gosh, too bad about that fall he took. Smells good, she says. Some for me? All you want. Coffee? Please. Lots of sugar. She sits down at the table and stares at the television on the counter. It isn't on, but she stares at it anyway. For all Brady knows, maybe she thinks it is on. You're not wearing your uniform, she says, meaning the blue button-up shirt with discount electronics on the pocket. He has 3 hanging in his closet. He irons them himself. Like vacuuming the floors and washing their clothes, ironing isn't in Ma's repertoire. Don't need to go in until 10, he says, and as if the words are a magic incantation, his phone wakes up and starts buzzing across the kitchen counter. He catches it just before it can fall off onto the floor. Don't answer it, honey boy. Pretend we went out for breakfast. It's tempting, but Brady is as incapable of letting a phone ring as he is of giving up his muddled and ever-changing plans for some grand act of destruction. He looks at the caller ID and isn't surprised to see Tones in the window. Anthony Tones Frobisher. The grand high panjandrum of discount electronics, Birch Hill Mall Branch. He picks up the phone and says, It's my late day, Tones. I know, but I need you to make a service call. I really, really do. Tones can't make Brady take a call on his late day, hence the wheedling tone. Plus, it's Mrs. Rollins, and you know she tips. Of course she does. She lives in Sugar Heights. The Cyber Patrol makes lots of service calls in Sugar Heights, and one of their customers, one of Brady's customers, was the late Olivia Trelawney. He was in her house twice on calls after he began conversing with her beneath Debbie's blue umbrella. And what a kick that was, seeing how much weight she'd lost, seeing how her hands had started to tremble. Also having access to her computer, it opened all sorts of possibilities. "I don't know, Tones. But of course he'll go, and not only because Mrs. Rollins tips, it's fun to go rolling past 729 Lilac Drive thinking, I'm responsible for those closed gates. All I had to do to give her the final push was add one little program to her Mac. Computers are wonderful.
"Listen, Brady, if you take this call, you don't have to work the store at all today. How's that? Just return the Beetle and then hang out wherever until it's time to fire up your stupid ice cream wagon."
"What about Freddy? Why don't you send her?" Flat out teasing now. If Tones could have sent Freddy, she'd already be on her way.
"Called in sick. Says she's got her period and it's killing her. Of course it's fucking bullshit. I know it, she knows it, and she knows I know it, but she'll put in a sexual harassment claim if I call her on it. She knows I know that, too."
Ma sees Brady smiling and smiles back. She raises a hand, closes it, and turns it back and forth. "Twist his balls, honey boy." Brady's smile widens into a grin. Ma may be a drunk. She may only cook once or twice a week. She can be as annoying as shit, but sometimes she can read him like a book.
"All right," Brady says. "How about I take my own car?" "You know I can't give you a mileage allowance for your personal vehicle," Tone says.
"Also, it's company policy," Brady says. "Right?"
"Well, yeah."
Shen Limited, DE's German parent company, believes the Cyber Patrol VWs are good advertising. Freddy Linkletter says that anyone who wants a guy driving a snot-green Beetle to fix his computer is insane, and on this point Brady agrees with her. Still, there must be a lot of insane people out there because they never lacked for service calls, although few tip as well as Paula Rollins.
"Okay," Brady says, "but you owe me one." "Thanks, buddy."
Brady kills the connection without bothering to say, "You're not my buddy and we both know it."
3. Paula Rollins is a full-figured blonde who lives in a 16-room faux Tudor mansion 3 blocks from the late Mrs. T's pile. She has all those rooms to herself. Brady doesn't know exactly what her deal is, but guesses she's some rich guy's second or third ex-trophy wife and that she did very well for herself in the settlement. Maybe the guy was too entranced by her knockers to bother with the prenup. Brady doesn't care much. He only knows she has enough to tip well and she's never tried to slap the make on him. That's good. He has no interest in Mrs. Rollins' full figure. She does grab his hand and just about pull him through the door, though.
"Oh, Brady, thank God."
She sounds like a woman being rescued from a desert island after 3 days without food or water, but he hears the little pause before she says his name and sees her eyes flick down to read it off his shirt, even though he's been here half a dozen times. So has Freddy, for that matter. Paula Rollins is a serial computer abuser. He doesn't mind that she doesn't remember him. Brady likes being forgettable.
"It just, I don't know what's wrong."
As if the dim-witted twat ever does. Last time he was here 6 weeks ago, it was a kernel panic, and she was convinced a computer virus had gobbled up all her files. Brady shooed her gently from the office and promised, not sounding too hopeful, to do what he could. Then he sat down, restarted the computer, and surfed for a while before calling her in and telling her he had been able to fix the problem just in time. "Another half hour," he said, and her files really would have been gone. She had tipped him $80. He and Ma had gone out to dinner that night and split a not-bad bottle of champagne.
"Tell me what happened," Brady says, grave as a neurosurgeon.
"I didn't do anything," she wails. She always wails. Many of his service call customers do. Not just the women, either. Nothing can unman a top-shelf executive more rapidly than the possibility that everything on his MacBook just went to data heaven.
She pulls him through the parlor. It's as long as an Amtrak dining car, and into her office.
"I cleaned up myself. I never let the housekeeper in here. Washed the windows, vacuumed the floor, and when I sat down to do my email, the damn computer wouldn't even turn on."
"Huh. Weird."
Brady knows Mrs. Rollins has a spick maid to do the household chores, but apparently the maid isn't allowed in the office, which is a good thing for her, because Brady has already spotted the problem, and if the maid had been responsible for it, she probably would have been fired.
Can you fix it, Brady?
Thanks to the tears swimming in them, Mrs. Rollins' big blue eyes are bigger than ever. Brady suddenly flashes on Betty Boop and those old cartoons you can look at on YouTube, thinks poop poop pee doop, and has to restrain a laugh. I'll sure try, he says gallantly.
I have to run across the street to Helen Wilcox's, she says, but I'll only be a few minutes. There's fresh coffee in the kitchen if you want it.
So saying, she leaves him alone in her big expensive house with fuck knows how many valuable pieces of jewelry scattered around upstairs. She's safe, though. Brady would never steal from a service client. He might be caught in the act. Even if he weren't, who would be the logical suspect? Duh. He didn't get away with mowing down those job-seeking idiots at City Center only to be arrested for stealing a pair of diamond earrings he wouldn't have any idea how to get rid of. He waits until the back door shuts, then goes into the parlor to watch her accompany her world-class tits across the street. When she's out of sight, he goes back to the office, crawls under her desk, and plugs in her computer. She must have yanked the plug so she could vacuum, then forgot to jack it back in. Her password screen comes on. Idly, just killing time, he types Paula, and her desktop, loaded with all her files, appears. God, people are so dumb. He goes on Debbie's blue umbrella to see if the FedEx cop has posted anything new. He hasn't, but Brady decides on the spur of the moment to send the debtorette a message after all. Why not? He learned in high school that thinking too long about writing doesn't work for him. Too many other ideas get into his head and start sliding all over each other. It's better to just fire away. That was how he wrote to Olivia Trelawney. White heat, baby. And it's also the way he wrote to Hodges, although he went over the message to the FedEx cop a couple of times to make sure he was keeping his style consistent. He writes in the same style now, only reminding himself to keep it short. How did I know about the hairnet and bleach, Detective Hodges? That stuff was withheld evidence because it was never in the paper or on TV. You say you are not stupid, but it sure looks that way to me. I think all that TV you watch has rotted your brain. What withheld evidence? I dare you to answer this. Brady looks this over and makes one change, a hyphen in the middle of hairnet. He can't believe he'll ever become a person of interest, but he knows that if he ever does, they'll ask him to provide a writing sample. He almost wishes he could give them one. He wore a mask when he drove into the crowd, and he wears another when he writes as the Mercedes killer. He hits send, then pulls down Mrs. Rollins' internet history. For a moment, he stops, bemused, when he sees several entries for white tie and tails. He knows what that is from something Freddie Linklater told him, a male escort service. Paula Rollins has a secret life, it seems. But then, doesn't everybody? It's no business of his. He deletes his visit to Under Debbie's Blue Umbrella, then opens his boxy service crate and takes out a bunch of random crap, utility discs, a modem, broken, but she won't know that, various thumb drives, and a voltage regulator that has nothing whatsoever to do with computer repair but looks technological. He also takes out a Lee Child paperback that he reads until he hears his client come in the back door 20 minutes later. When Mrs. Rollins pokes her head into the study, the paperback is out of sight, and Brady is packing up the random shit. She favors him with an anxious smile. Any luck? At first it looked bad, Brady says, but I tracked down your problem. The trimmer switch was bad, and that shut down your Dana circuit. In a case like that, the computer's programmed not to start up, because if it did, you might lose all your data. He looks at her gravely. The darn thing might even catch fire. It's been known to happen.
Oh, my dear Jesus,
she says, packing each word with drama and placing one hand high on her chest.
Are you sure it's okay?
Good as gold, he says. Check it out. He starts the computer and looks politely away while she types in her numbfuck password. She opens a couple of files, then turns to him smiling.
Brady, you are a gift from God.
My ma used to tell me the same thing until I got old enough to buy beer. She laughs as if this were the funniest thing she has heard in her whole life. Brady laughs with her because he has a sudden vision, kneeling on her shoulders and driving a butcher knife from her own kitchen deep into her screaming mouth. He can almost feel the gristle giving way. 4. Hodges has been checking the Blue Umbrella site frequently, and he's reading the Mercedes killer's follow-up message only minutes after Brady hits send. Hodges is grinning, a big one that smooths his skin and makes him almost handsome. Their relationship has been officially established. Hodges the fisherman, Mr. Mercedes the fish. But a wily fish, he reminds himself, one capable of making a sudden lunge and snapping the line. He will have to be played carefully, reeled toward the boat slowly. If Hodges is able to do that, if he's patient, sooner or later Mr. Mercedes will agree to a meeting. Hodges is sure of it. Because if he can't nudge me into offing myself, that leaves just one alternative, and that's murder. The smart thing for Mr. Mercedes to do would be to just walk away. If he does that, the road ends. But he won't. He's pissed. But that's only part of it, and a small part at that. Hodges wonders if Mr. Mercedes knows just how crazy he is. And if he knows, there's one nugget of hard information here.
I think all that TV you watch has rotted your brain.
Up to this morning, Hodges has only suspected that Mr. Mercedes has been watching his house. Now he knows. Motherfucker has been on the street, and more than once. He grabs his legal pad and starts jotting possible follow-up messages. It has to be good because his fish feels the hook. The pain of it makes him angry even though he doesn't yet know what it is. He needs to be a lot angrier before he figures it out, and that means taking a risk. Hodges must jerk the line to seat the hook deeper, despite the risk the line may break. What? He remembers something Pete Huntley said at lunch, just a remark in passing, and the answer comes to him. Hodges writes on his pad, then rewrites, then polishes. He reads the finished message over and decides it will do. It's short and mean. There's something you forgot, sucker. Something a false confessor couldn't know. Or a real confessor, for that matter, unless Mr. Mercedes checked out his rolling murder weapon from stem to stern before climbing in, and Hodges is betting the guy didn't. If he's wrong, the line snaps and the fish swims away. But there's an old saying, no risk, no reward. He wants to send the message right away, but knows it's a bad idea. Let the fish swim around in circles a little longer with that bad old hook in his mouth. The question is what to do in the meantime. TV never had less appeal for him. He gets an idea. They're coming in bunches this morning, and pulls out the bottom drawer of his desk. Here's a box filled with the small flip-up pads he used to carry with him when he and Pete were doing street interviews. He never expected to need one of these again, but he takes one now and stows it in the back pocket of his chinos. It fits just right. 5. Hodges walks halfway down Harper Road, then starts knocking on doors, just like in the old days. Crossing and recrossing the street, missing no one, working his way back. It's a weekday, but a surprising number of people answer his knock or ring. Some are stay-at-home moms, but many are retirees like himself, fortunate enough to have paid for their homes before the bottom fell out of the economy, but in less than great shape otherwise. Not living day-to-day, or even week-to-week maybe, but having to balance out the cost of food against the cost of all those old folks' medicines as the end of the month nears. His story is simple, because simple is always best. He says there have been break-ins a few blocks over, kids probably, and he's checking to see if anyone in his own neighborhood has noticed any vehicles that seem out of place and have shown up more than once. They'd probably be cruising even slower than the 25-mile-an-hour speed limit, he says. He doesn't have to say any more. They all watch the cop shows and know what casing the joint means. He shows them his ID, which has retired stamped in red across the name and vitals below his photo. He's careful to say that no, he hasn't been asked by the police to do this canvassing, The last thing in the world he wants is one of his neighbors calling the Murrow building downtown to check up on him. It was his own idea. He lives in the neighborhood, too, after all, and has a personal stake in its security. Mrs. Melbourne, the widow whose flowers so fascinated Odell, invites him in for coffee and cookies. Hodges takes her up on it because she seems lonely. It's his first real conversation with her, and he quickly realizes she's eccentric at best, downright bonkers at worst. Articulate, though. He has to give her that. She explains about the black SUVs she's observed,
with tinted windows you can't see through, just like on 24,
and tells him about their special antennas. Whippers, she calls them, waving her hand back and forth to demonstrate. Uh-huh, Hodges says. Let me make a note of that. He turns a page in his pad and jots, I have to get out of here, on the new one.
That's a good idea, she says, bright-eyed. I've just got to tell you how sorry I was when your wife left you, Detective Hodges. She did, didn't she?
We agreed to disagree, Hodges says, with an amiability he doesn't feel.
It's so nice to meet you in person and know you're keeping an eye out. Have another cookie.
Hodges glances at his watch, snaps his pad closed, and gets up. I'd love to, but I'd better roll. Got a noon appointment.
She scans his bulk and says, Doctor?
Chiropractor. She frowns, transforming her face into a walnut shell with eyes.
Think that over, Detective Hodges. Backcrackers are dangerous. There are people who have lain down on those tables and never walked again.
She sees him to the door. As he steps onto the porch, she says,
I'd check on that ice cream man, too. This spring, it seems like he's always around. Do you suppose Loeb's ice cream checks out the people they hire to drive those little trucks? I hope so, because that one looks suspicious. He might be a pederast.
I'm sure their drivers have references, but I'll look into it.
Another good idea,
she exclaims. Hodges wonders what he'd do if she produced a long hook like in the old-time vaudeville shows and tried to yank him back inside. A childhood memory comes to him, the witch in Hansel and Gretel.
Also, I just thought of this. I've seen several vans lately. They look like delivery vans. They have business names on them. But anyone can make up a business name, don't you think?
It's always possible, Hodges says, descending the steps.
You should call into number 17, too, she points down the hill. It's almost all the way down to Hanover Street. They have people who come late and play loud music.
She sways forward in the doorway, almost bowing.
It could be a dope den, one of those crack houses.
Hodges thanks her for the tip and trudges across the street. Black SUVs and the Mr. Tasty guy, he thinks, plus the delivery vans filled with Al-Qaeda terrorists. Across the street he finds a stay-at-home dad, Alan Bowfinger by name. Just don't confuse me with Goldfinger, he says, and invites Hodges to sit in one of the lawn chairs on the left side of his house where there's shade. Hodges is happy to take him up on this. Bowfinger tells him that he makes a living writing greeting cards.
I specialize in the slightly snarky ones, like on the outside it'll say, Happy birthday, who's the fairest of them all? And when you open it up, there's a piece of shiny foil with a crack running down the middle of it.
Yeah? And what's the message? Bowfinger holds up his hands as if framing it.
Not you, but we love you anyway.
Kinda mean, Hodges ventures.
True, but it ends with an expression of love. That's what sells the card. First the poke, then the hug. As to your purpose today, Mr. Hodges, or do I call you detective?
Just mister these days.
I haven't seen anything but the usual traffic. No slow cruisers except people looking for addresses and the ice cream truck after school lets out.
Bowfinger rolls his eyes.
Did you get an earful from Mrs. Melbourne?
Well,
she's a member of NICAP, Bowfinger says. That stands for National Investigations Committee on Aerial Phenomena.
Weather stuff? Tornadoes and cloud formations?
Flying saucers. Bowfinger raises his hands to the sky. She thinks they walk among us.
Hodges says something that would never have passed his lips if he'd still been on active duty and conducting an official investigation. She thinks Mr. Tasty might be a pederast.
Bowfinger laughs until tears squirt out of his eyes.
Oh, God, he says. That guy's been around for 5 or 6 years driving his little truck and jingling his little bells. How many peeds do you think he's roasted in all that time?
Don't know, Hodges says, getting to his feet. Dozens, probably. He holds out his hand and Bowfinger shakes it. Another thing Hodges is discovering about retirement, his neighbors have stories and personalities, some of them are even interesting. As he's putting his notepad away, a look of alarm comes over Bowfinger's face. What? Hodges asks, at once on point. Bowfinger points across the street and says, You didn't eat any of her cookies, did you?
Yeah. Why?
I'd stay close to the toilet for a few hours if I were you. 6.
When he gets back to his house, his arches throbbing and his ankles singing high C, the light on his answering machine is blinking. It's Pete Huntley, and he sounds excited.
Call me, he says. This is unbelievable, unfucking real.
Hodges is suddenly, irrationally sure that Pete and his pretty new partner Isabel have nailed Mr. Mercedes after all. He feels a deep stab of jealousy and, crazy but true, anger. He hits Pete on speed dial, his heart hammering, but his call goes right to voicemail.
Got your message, Hodges says. Call back when you can.
He kills the phone, then sits still, drumming his fingers on the edge of his desk. He tells himself it doesn't matter who catches the psycho son of a bitch, but it does. For one thing, it's certainly going to mean that his correspondence with the perk, funny how that word gets in your head, will come out, and that may put him in some fairly warm soup. But it's not the important thing. The important thing is that without Mr. Mercedes, things will go back to what they were. Afternoon TV and playing with his father's gun.
He takes out his yellow legal pad and begins transcribing notes on his neighborhood walk-around.
After a minute or two of this, he tosses the pad back into the case folder and slams it closed. If Pete and Izzy James have popped the guy, Mrs. Melbourne's vans and sinister black SUVs don't mean shit. He thinks about going on Debbie's blue umbrella and sending Merce Kill a message. Did they catch you? Ridiculous, but weirdly attractive. His phone rings and he snatches it up, but it's not Pete. It's Olivia Trelawney's sister. Oh, he says. Hi, Mrs. Patterson. How you doing?
I'm fine, she says. And it's Janie, remember? Me, Janie, you, Bill.
Janie, right.
You don't sound exactly thrilled to hear from me, Bill.
Is she being the tiniest bit flirty? Wouldn't that be nice?
No, no, I'm happy you called, but I don't have anything to report.
I didn't expect you would. I called about Mom. The nurse at Sunny Acres, who's most familiar with her case, works the day shift in the McDonald building where my mother has her little suite of rooms. I asked her to call if Mom brightened up. She still does that.
Yes, you told me.
Well, the nurse called just a few minutes ago to tell me Mom's back, at least for the time being. She might be clear for a day or two, then it's into the clouds again. Do you still want to go see her?
I think so, Hodges says cautiously. But it would have to be this afternoon. I'm waiting on a call.
Is it about the man who took her car?
Janie's excited, as I should be, Hodges tells himself. That's what I need to find out. Can I call you back?
Absolutely. You have my cell number?
Yeah.
Yeah, she says, gently mocking.
It makes him smile in spite of his nerves.
Call me as soon as you can.
I will. He breaks the connection and the phone rings while it's still in his hand. This time it's Pete and he's more excited than ever.
Billy! I gotta go back. We've got him in an interview room. IR4, as a matter of fact. Remember how you always used to say that was your lucky one? But I had to call you. We got him, partner. We fucking got him.
Got who? Hodges asks, keeping his voice steady.
His heartbeat is steady now, too, but the beats are hard enough to feel in his temples. Womp and womp and womp.
Fucking Davis, Pete shouts. Who else?
Davis. Not Mr. Mercedes, but Donnie Davis, the camera-friendly wife murderer. Bill Hodges closes his eyes in relief. It's the wrong emotion to feel, but he feels it nevertheless. He says, So the body that game warden found near his cabin turned out to be Sheila Davis's? You sure?
positive. Who did you blow to get the DNA results so fast?
When Hodges was on the force, they were lucky to get DNA results within a calendar month of sample submission, and 6 weeks was the average.
We don't need DNA. For the trial, sure, but...
What do you mean you don't?
Shut up and listen, okay? He just walked in off the street and copped to it. No lawyer, no bullshit justifications. Listened to the Miranda and said he didn't want a lawyer, only wanted to get it off his chest.
Jesus. As smooth as he was in all the interviews we had with him, are you sure he's not fucking with you? Playing some sort of long game?
Thinking it's the kind of thing Mr. Mercedes would try to do if they nailed him. Not just a game, but a long game.
Isn't that why he tries to create alternate writing styles in his poison pen letters?
Billy, it's not just his wife. You remember those dollies he had on the side? Girls with big hair and inflated tits and names like Bobby Sue?
Sure, what about them?
When this breaks, those young ladies are going to get on their knees and thank God they're still alive.
I'm not following you.
Turnpike Joe, Billy. 5 women raped and killed at various interstate rest stops between here and Pennsylvania starting back in 94 and ending in 08. Donnie Davis says it's him. Davis is Turnpike Joe. He's given us times and places and descriptions. It all fits. This, it blows my mind.
Mine too, Hodges says, and he absolutely means it. Congratulations.
Thanks, but I didn't do anything except show up this morning. Pete laughs wildly. I feel like I won the megabucks.
Hodges doesn't feel like that, but at least he hasn't lost the megabucks. He still has a case to work.
I gotta get back in there, Billy, before he changes his mind.
Yeah, yeah, but Pete, before you go...
What?
Get him a court appointed.
Ah, Billy.
I'm serious. Interrogate the shit out of him, but before you start, announce, for the record, that you're getting him lawyered up. You can wring him dry before anyone shows up at Murrow, but you have to get this right. Are you hearing me?
Yeah, okay, that's a good call. I'll have Izzy do it.
Great, now get back in there and nail him down.
Pete actually crows.
Hodges has read about people doing that, but hasn't ever heard it done except by roosters until now.
Turnpike Joe, Billy! Fucking Turnpike Joe! Do you believe it?
He hangs up before his ex-partner can reply. Hodges sits where he is for almost 5 minutes, waiting until a belated case of the shakes subsides. Then he calls Janie Patterson.
It wasn't about the man we're looking for.
Sorry, no, another case.
Oh, too bad.
Yeah, you'll still come with me to the nursing home?
You bet. I'll be waiting on the sidewalk.
Before leaving, he checks the blue umbrella site one last time. Nothing there, and he has no intention of sending his own carefully crafted message today. Tonight will be soon enough. Let the fish feel the hook a while longer. He leaves his house with no premonition that he won't be back.
7. Sunny Acres is ritzy. Elizabeth Wharton is not. She's in a wheelchair, hunched over in a posture that reminds Hodges of Rodin's Thinker. Afternoon sunlight slants in through the window, turning her hair into a silver cloud so fine it's a halo. Outside the window, on a rolling and perfectly manicured lawn, a few golden oldies are playing a slow-motion game of croquet. Mrs. Wharton's croquet days are over, as are her days of standing up. When Hodges last saw her, with Pete Huntley beside him and Olivia Trelawney sitting next to her, she was bent. Now she's broken. Janie, vibrant in tapered white slacks and a blue and white striped sailor's shirt, kneels beside her, stroking one of Mrs. Wharton's badly twisted hands.
How are you today, dear one? She asks. You look better.
If this is true, Hodges is horrified.
Mrs. Wharton peers at her daughter with faded blue eyes that express nothing, not even puzzlement.
Hodges' heart sinks. He enjoyed the ride out here with Janie, enjoyed looking at her, enjoyed getting to know her even more, and that's good. It means the trip hasn't been entirely wasted. Then a minor miracle occurs. The old lady's cataract-tinged eyes clear, the cracked, lipstickless lips spread in a smile.
Hello, Janie.
She can only raise her head a little, but her eyes flick to Hodges. Now they look cold.
Craig.
Thanks to their conversation on the ride out, Hodges knows who that is.
This isn't Craig, Lovey. This is a friend of mine. His name is Bill Hodges. You've met him before.
No, I don't believe...
She trails off, frowning now, then says,
You're one of the detectives.
Yes, ma'am. He doesn't even consider telling her he's retired. Best to keep things on a straight line while there are still a few circuits working in her head. Her frown deepens, creating rivers of wrinkles.
You thought Livy left her key in her car so that man could steal it. She told you and told you, but you never believed her.
Hodges copies Janie taking a knee beside the wheelchair. Mrs. Wharton, I now think we might have been wrong about that.
Of course you were.
She shifts her gaze back to her remaining daughter, looking up at her from beneath the bony shelf of her brow. It's the only way she can look.
Where's Craig?
I divorced him last year, Mom.
She considers, then says,
Good riddance to bad rubbish.
I couldn't agree more. Can Bill ask you a few questions?
I don't see why not, but I want some orange juice and my pain pills.
I'll go down to the nurse's suite and see if it's time, she says. Bill, are you okay if I...
He nods and flicks two fingers in a go-go gesture. As soon as she's out the door, Hodges gets to his feet, bypasses the visitor's chair, and sits on Elizabeth Wharton's bed with his hands clasped between his knees. He has his pad, but he's afraid taking notes might distract her. The two of them regard each other silently. Hodges is fascinated by the silver nimbus around the old lady's head. There are signs that one of the orderlies combed her hair that morning, but it's gone its own wild way in the hours since. Hodges is glad. The scoliosis has twisted her body into a thing of ugliness, but her hair is beautiful. Crazy and beautiful. I think, he says, we treated your daughter badly, Mrs. Wharton. Yes, indeed. Even if Mrs. T was an unwitting accomplice and Hodges hasn't entirely dismissed the idea that she left her key in the ignition, he and Pete did a piss-poor job. It's easy, too easy, to either disbelieve or disregard someone you dislike. We were blinded by certain preconceptions, and for that I'm sorry.
Are you talking about Janie? Janie and Craig? He hit her, you know. She tried to get him to stop using that dope stuff he liked and he hit her. She says only once, but I believe it was more.
She lifts one slow hand and taps her nose with a pale finger.
A mother can tell.
This isn't about Janie. I'm talking about Olivia.
He made Livy stop taking her pills. She said it was because she didn't want to be a dope addict like Craig, but it wasn't the same. She needed those pills.
Are you talking about her antidepressants?
They were pills that made her able to go out.
She pauses, considering.
There were other ones, too, that kept her from touching things over and over. She had strange ideas, my Livy, but she was a good person just the same. Underneath, she was a very good person.
Mrs. Wharton begins to cry. There's a box of Kleenex on the nightstand. Hodges takes a few and holds them out to her, but when he sees how difficult it is for her to close her hand, he wipes her eyes for her.
Thank you, sir. Is your name Hedges?
Hodges, ma'am.
You were the nice one. The other one was very mean to Livy. She said he was laughing at her, laughing all the time. She said she could see it in his eyes.
Was that true? If so, he's ashamed of Pete, and ashamed of himself for not realizing. Who suggested she stop taking her pills, do you remember? Janie has come back with the orange juice in a small paper cup that probably holds her mother's pain medication. Hodges glimpses her from the corner of his eye and uses the same two fingers to motion her away again. He doesn't want Mrs. Wharton's attention divided or taking any pills that will further muddle her already muddled recollection. Mrs. Wharton is silent. Then just when Hodges is afraid she won't answer.
It was her pen pal.
Did she meet him under the blue umbrella? Debbie's blue umbrella?
She never met him. Not in person.
What I mean,
The blue umbrella was make-believe.
From beneath the white brows, her eyes are calling him a perfect idiot.
It was a thing in her computer. Frankie was her computer, pen pal.
He always feels a kind of electric shock in his midsection when fresh info drops. Frankie. Surely not the guy's real name, but names have power, and aliases often have meaning. Frankie. He told her to stop taking her medicine?
Yes, he said it was hooking her. Where's Janie? I want my pills.
She'll be back any minute, I'm sure. Mrs. Wharton broods into her lap for a moment.
Frankie said he took all the same medicines and that's why he did what he did. He said he felt better after he stopped taking them. He said that after he stopped, he knew what he did was wrong. But it made him sad because he couldn't take it back. That's what he said. And that life wasn't worth living. I told Livy she should stop talking to him. I said he was bad, that he was poison. And she said...
The tears are coming again.
She said she had to save him.
This time, when Janie comes into the doorway, Hodges nods to her. Janie puts a pair of blue pills into her mother's pursed and seeking mouth and gives her a drink of juice.
Thank you, Livy.
Hodges sees Janie wince, then smile.
You're welcome, dear. She turns to Hodges. I think we should go, Bill. She's very tired.
He can see that, but is still reluctant to leave. There's a feeling you get when the interview isn't done. When there's at least one more apple hanging on the tree. Mrs. Wharton, did Olivia say anything else about Frankie? Because you're right, he is bad. I'd like to find him so he can't hurt anyone else.
Livy never would have left her key in her car. Never.
Elizabeth Wharton sits hunched in her bar of sun, a human parenthesis in a fuzzy blue robe, unaware that she's topped with a gauze of silver light. The finger comes up again. Admonitory, she says.
That dog we had never threw up on the rug again. Just that once.
Janie takes Hodges' hand and mouths, let's go. Habits die hard, and Hodges speaks the old formula as Janie bends down and kisses first her mother's cheek and then the corner of her dry mouth. Thank you for your time, Mrs. Wharton. You've been very helpful. As they reach the door, Mrs. Wharton speaks clearly.
She still wouldn't have committed suicide if not for the ghosts.
Hodges turns back. Beside him, Janie Patterson is wide-eyed. What ghosts, Mrs. Wharton?
One was the baby,
she says.
The poor thing who was killed with all those others. Livy heard that baby in the night crying and crying. She said the baby's name was Patricia.
In her house? Olivia heard this in her house? Elizabeth Wharton manages the smallest of nods, a mere dip of the chin.
And sometimes the mother, she said the mother would accuse her.
She looks up at them from her wheelchair hunch.
She would scream, "Why did you let him murder my baby?" That's why Livy killed herself.
8. It's Friday afternoon, and the suburban streets are feverish with kids released from school. There aren't many on Harper Road, but there are still some, and this gives Brady a perfect reason to cruise slowly past number 63 and peek in the window. Except he can't, because the drapes are drawn. And the overhang to the left of the house is empty except for the lawnmower. Instead of sitting in his house and watching TV where he belongs, the debt Rhett is sporting about in his crappy old Toyota. Sporting about where? It probably doesn't matter, but Hodges' absence makes Brady vaguely uneasy. Two little girls trot to the curb with money clutched in their hands. They have undoubtedly been taught both at home and at school to never approach strangers, especially strange men, but who could be less strange than good old Mr. Tasty? He sells them a cone each, one chocolate and one vanilla. He joshes with them, asks how they got so pretty. They giggle. The truth is, one's ugly and the other's worse.
As he serves them and makes change, he thinks about the missing Corolla, wondering if this break in Hodges' afternoon routine has anything to do with him. Another message from Hodges on the blue umbrella might cast some light, give an idea of where the ex-cop's head is at. Even if it doesn't, Brady wants to hear from him.